And now, beloved listeners, it's time for our promised tribute to Ken Inglis, the historian who died a couple of days ago, aged 88. And right to the end, we had plans to talk to Ken about his final work, which was on the De Niro boys. For the moment, I'd like to take us back to a couple of interviews that we recorded with Ken in recent years. And the first involves the ABC. Ken was the official historian of the first volume of ABC History, and later, when the ABC decided not to underwrite the sequel, Black Ink came in and helped out. But on this occasion, we're talking about Volume 1 of a truly magisterial work. And I began by asking Ken, how could an outsider know more about the ABC than an insider?
Well, I don't think it's true. I take a long time over writing, and I have an intense interest in the ABC. Outsider. The first time, for the first book, I had a wonderful research assistant, Jan Brazier, who was very good at finding her way to the useful documents and the useful people. The second time, I have no research assistant, but I have the electronic research assistants of email, and I found that a remarkable help as an outsider getting to insiders.
You were telling me in Melbourne that the most improbable people immediately replied to your emails when they might have not returned a phone call or been a bit tardy with a letter.
Yes. I hope we might be talking about Bob Mansfield during this conversation. He was someone who, right at the top of one of those telly companies, I wrote to, I said, I noticed, am I right in thinking that the government didn't respond in any way formally to your review of the ABC, that they commissioned you to appoint and recommend how to cut it? And he said, he wrote back within an hour, I think, saying, yes, you're right. They didn't respond in any way at all. It was rather disappointing, but that's the sort of thing that happens when you take on this kind of job.
Mm. It's interesting, Ken. I've got both volumes in front of me, the old and the new. The Old Testament covers from 1932 to 1983, virtually half a century. The New Testament, whose ABC, covers a little over 20 years. Yet the New Testament is considerably thicker. How do you account for that? Is the ABC simply generating more history now as it gets bigger and more complex, or the politics are more intense?
I think it may be. I may be getting garrulous as I get older, more garrulous as I get older, but I think that there has been much more change within those 20 years than there had been in the previous 50, or 23 years than the previous 50, stemming largely, I think, from having fixed terms for chief executives. As you know, Charlie Moses was general manager for 30 years, and Tal Duckmanton for 16 years. So for almost the whole of the 50 years of the, what you kindly call the Old Testament, there are only two chief executives who are both very good at keeping things going. And
whereas now, of course, they come in and out the door like, well, it's a revolving door, isn't it? Now?
Yeah, they've hardly, only one has ever gone since the change. Only one has ever gone at the time that he chose. They are appointed only for 5 years. They can be reappointed only for another 5 years. There's a built-in instability there, and there is less and less security of tenure among the executives and the broadcasters. Mm. And I think that's a generator of change that wasn't there in the early days.
One of the things that surprises me, and I must say pleases me about the book, and we'll look at some of the history shortly, but while we're still looking at the overview, is that although I know you are passionate about public broadcasting and you care for it deeply, you are remarkably gentle about the people you're describing. It's got an almost, heavens above you, this would be embarrassing, but you know, you seem to be looking down an almost godlike way and forgiving people. Even Jonathan Shire is given a fair shake by Ken Inglis.
Well, I don't know about godlike. I never enjoy reading the work of academics who write as if they could have done better the job of the people they are describing. whose lives they are chronicling. It's a fault that military historians, I think, are particularly prone to. And I think it's good for the outside historian to wonder how he or she would have done anything better. I try to remember that. I think my teachers encouraged that habit of mind. Jeff Blaney and I were taught by the same teachers at the University of Melbourne, and I would say that he has a dispassionateness which I enjoy very much, and in which I recognise the influence of the history school that we studied in.
Well, as a result, the book seems to me incredibly fair and balanced, and people that might have been targets for anger from another are treated, as I said, with remarkable fairness. It's still nonetheless a book of heroes and villains, and we might talk about a few of them later. Had it not been for the need to protect your sources, and you've clearly spoken to everyone apart from emailing them, and if it wasn't for the laws of libel, could there be a third book, an unwritten version?
Oh dear, not by me. I don't know. There are lots of things I didn't get to the bottom of, and I either said that I didn't get to the bottom of them, or I left them out. If you won't mind me mentioning one example, two people from Radio National were said to have called on you, with or without, on or not on the initiative of the, this is during the Shire time, on or not on the initiative of the chairman. They did or did not say certain things to you, and certain consequences did or did not happen. I found so many different versions of that I started a file called Rashomon, and and I noticed that there's not a word in the book about it.
No, so, I did wonder about that, I must admit. But that's the only thing that I can think of that isn't in it. Okay, now, let's talk about corporation and commission, because that to you is enormously important. It doesn't simply allow you to separate, you know, the two volumes, because you see those words as flowing into attitudes externally and internally about this extraordinary organisation.
Yes, I do. I like the word commission. It signals that the ABC was one of those peculiarly Australian institutions, the statutory authority. And I think we underrate the importance and value to liberal democracy of the arm's length statutory authority, which the ABC has always been, and in particular the provision which enabled the commission, not the government, to appoint the chief executives. Corporation, it's true, was the name in the great imperial model, the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation. But I don't think that's why the ABC became corporation in 1983.
I'm sure you're right.
It came out of the committee chaired by Alex Dix, you'll remember, which was set up bipartisanly in the last days of the Fraser government, when we had a bipartisan minister, Tony Staley. Not bipartisan, you know what I mean, that he was an even-handed and fair-minded minister. And he got agreement of his shadow to appoint a committee under the businessman Alex Dix. And it was Dix's committee that recommended change to the word corporation, I think because they liked the music of that word as it was beginning to sound in the 1980s. It made the ABC sound like a business. And they
That's the point, isn't it? That if it's a business, you can impose different terms of reference on it, different standards, different expectations.
Yes, well, it's easy for you to try. It still remained, didn't it, a statutory authority at that arm's length of government.
Okay.
But certainly it became rhetorically and practically easier to talk about it, the ABC as being part of an industry and that sort of talk.
Okay, you've mentioned one arm's reasonably good minister, and that was Tony Staley. Another that gets quite an accolade from you is Michael Duffy, not to be confused with the ABC broadcaster. But how arm's length, how statutory has the ABC been in its corporate era?
In the time of Michael Duffy, pretty much so. Certainly he never tried to influence the ABC in any way at all, except once he asked Geoffrey Whitehead, the first managing director, couldn't we have more jazz? he couldn't always stop interventions on by his bosses, but though he tried, by his seniors, though he tried, you recall a story about a caucus meeting in 1984 when Bob Hawke and Bill Hayden were being very abusive of the ABC and menacing towards it and wanting Duffy to do something about it, and he just leaned back in his chair and said, "Read the fucking act." And they passed to the next item on the agenda. Bob Hawke told ABC people, I think, that it wasn't the job of the ABC to have Four Corners meddling in the affairs of his friend Sir Peter Abels. Paul Keating could have come close to the most drastic intervention ever in ABC autonomy. The story is told by Don Watson in his book about his time, Confessions of a Bleeding Heart, of his time with Paul Keating, that in 1994, people in Paul Keating's office were thinking of legislating to remove the whole board of the ABC and recompose it on lines that seemed more congenial to them. That would have been, unfortunately for that plan, Paul Keating's attention was distracted at that moment by Rupert Murdoch and the creation of Fox Studios. So we'll never know what would have happened. However, I don't think it was until 1996 that a government interfered with or imposed financial restrictions on the ABC with punitive intent. There had been financial restrictions in Hawke and Keating times for a mixture of reasons, usually opposed by, or always opposed, I think, by Michael Duffy, or usually. But there was a difference when the coalition came in and when, thanks to Laura Tingle's revelations, we know how the coalition set about reducing the ABC with a taming or punitive intent. John Howard's Expenditure Review Committee asked Richard Alston, the Minister for Communications, for suggestions on how to reduce ABC funding by about $50 million a year in a hurry. And 6 months later, thanks to Laura Tingle, the minister's submission became possibly the first document headed Cabinet in Confidence ever to be posted on the internet. Mm. And Alston says there, options examined in the submission are inconsistent with government election commitments to maintain ABC funding levels, but will assist achievement of the government's fiscal policy strategy. And not only its fiscal strategy, it will also give us the ability to influence future ABC functions and activities more directly. I don't know of any intervention or any use of budgetary policy before that moment which had that kind of intention.
Ken, the master of the English language, talking to me in 2006 about the publication of Volume 2 of his History of the ABC. Whose ABC? The Australian Broadcasting Corporation, 1983 to 2006, published by Black Ink. Now, as I tweeted when Ken died last week, he wrote so many books and we can't mention them all. The first was in 1958 and it was called Hospital and Community, a history of the Royal Melbourne Hospital. And his last book, still to be published, as I mentioned earlier, concerns the Deneira boys. But in our last segment, here's an extract from an interview in 2008 on the publication of the third edition of Sacred Places, War Memorials in the Australian Landscape. And I began by asking Ken why he felt the need for a revised version of a book first published in 1998.
It was the publisher's idea. They said they would do another edition if I did an epilogue covering the last 10 years. And that, as an old author, I found that an irresistible invitation. And then when I started looking at the story, I was astonished, as I say in the author's note to the new edition, astonished at how much making and remaking of war memorials there was in that 10 years. I think probably more than in any decade since the 1920s. So in a sense, the epilogue is an attempt, an exploration of that extraordinary proliferation and resurgence.
You make the point quietly. Well, I'll make it in a different way. I'll make it more satirically than you do, but really we should be remembering ACT Day, because we leave the N's bit out a huge amount, don't we?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Indeed, they do.
I mean, Australians don't even really think about the New Zealand as much.
No. They've put a New Zealand memorial in Anzac Avenue now, but that's only seen by people who go to Canberra. And there's going to be now an Australian memorial in Wellington, but that doesn't do much to enhance Australian perception of New Zealand contribution. But yes, and it's always been a rather touchy matter, I think, for New Zealanders. What about the N and the Z?
Yeah. I understand from your new book that the memorials are evolving and changing, that they're now being erected to honour the work of peacekeepers, as there's an increasing commitment for both the Australian Defence Force and the country's police forces in the region.
Yes. One of the new questions for anyone looking at war memorials now is what is a war memorial? Are memorials to peacekeeping, are they war memorials? I think the consensus is yes, they are. What about the memorials to dead policemen? And what about memorials to national servicemen? What about memorials to serving military personnel who haven't been in wars? And most interestingly, it seemed to me, what are the memorials to victims of terrorists? There's a controversy raging in the United States about the proper commemoration of the horrendous moment of 9/11. And I've included in the epilogue the memorialisation of the victims of the Bali bombings in 2002 throughout around Australia. And some people said they got comfort in comparing them to war memorials, or in having rituals around them which were like the rituals around war memorials, like Anzac Day.
And I see on page 475, Ken, that there's a war memorial to honour animals, other than horses and a donkey, and a stone dog was unveiled in 2001, commemorating 11 Labradors, all named,
yes,
who died in service as trackers in Vietnam.
Yes, wasn't that nice?
I'm interested in the names issue. You talk about a lot of the memorials these days not having names on them, apart, God forbid, from the corporate sponsors.
Yes. It's a bit of a jolt, isn't it? You may be thinking of, or one I think of, is, which I start the epilogue with, the one in Mandurah near Perth, where the effort to find the names, to decide what names to put on, defeated the makers for reasons that I mentioned. But they had to have corporate sponsors, and the corporate sponsors' names get put on the memorials, including the Japanese firm, and yeah.
I think we'll have a moment of silence while we contemplate that particular abomination. Now, clearly, the more memorials built after World War One and World War Two were very focused in purpose, and they did, in fact, almost invariably include names.
They did. And almost uniquely, most of them included the names of people who returned as well as people who died. In a way, the starting point of my book was reading D.H. Lawrence's description of a war memorial in Thirroul in New South Wales, which he called Mullumbimby. And he noticed there, or two things that stick in my mind. One is that he sees pathos in the memorial, in the figure, whereas I suppose I'd grown up not seeing the pathos, seeing the assertiveness of them. But the other thing is that he says that all the names are there of people who returned and as well as those who died. And I wondered why that was so. And eventually I went for the explanation that only the AIF, only the Australian Army, was recruited entirely by volunteers, so that the rhetoric about made the supreme offered their sacrifices, offered their lives. This was true literally in a way that it wasn't true of any other major armed force, belligerent armed force in that war.
Ken, I suddenly see in my mind's eye that immense memorial to the Vietnam vets in the United States. Now, that great long slab of black stone with those thousands of names upon it. I think names are a damn good idea.
Yes, and that one has nothing but names, does it?
That's it, names, names,
yeah.
Names.
And it's been, I think that memorial astonishingly done by a 19-year-old architecture student of Chinese origin at Yale. That's it. That has influenced memorials all around the world, including Australia. If you visit the Ballarat ex-prisoners of war memorial, which was opened in 2004, you see there a long black wall. A couple of the police memorials that have been put up have long black or grey walls, and the names.
Ken, you mentioned Ballarat. I understand they expect that to attract an estimated 100,000 visitors a year. Now, this raises another issue that very often now it seems that war memorials or memorials on that theme are being erected with tourism in sight.
Yes, the one almost pure case of that in the epilogue is the one on the Great Ocean Road in Victoria, which was technically a war memorial from the 1930s, but hardly anybody knew that it was. It was the local tourist authority which had the idea of putting up statues of two diggers and new inscriptions and a much more visible monument. And they then were able to say this is the longest war memorial in the world, and even to say it was the greatest war memorial in the world. But that has a slightly odd aspect because they couldn't get local historians to say the right things about its origin, because the road wasn't originally conceived as a war memorial at all.
Ken, not everyone finds comfort from a memorial, whatever its shape or size. You write about some of the Vietnam vets who, and I quote, could not stomach ceremonies that incorporated the celebration of the regime their nation had sent them to sustain. Some looked for modes of commemoration that transcended the division of participants into allies and enemies.
Yes, and that applied very much to those Vietnam veterans who've gone back to Vietnam and worked on projects which are a kind of, if not penitence, a kind of recompense to the people against whom they had fought. And then I also mentioned the rather touching story of blokes who go to a kind of refuge in North Queensland when they find society and family intolerable, at any rate, for the time being.
This is the Pandanus Park.
Yes, yes. That's I haven't been to it. I've only read about it and seen pictures of it. But and they made their own little monument of stone, and they have piles of stones, and they have their own modest services.
But they had to fight for that piece of land, didn't they?
It was, they did.
Les Hiddens, one of the famous Vietnam vets, best known on television as the Bush Tucker Man, helped them select the land, and they just sort of grabbed some crown land. And
that's right.
Yeah. But going back to the blokes in Vietnam, I like those stories. A kindergarten, a school, a water filtering plant. In a sense, were the best sort of war memorials.
Yes, yes, indeed. There were attempts in Australia to broaden the meanings of the Vietnam memorials. There were supposed to be contending messages on the one in Anzac Avenue, Anzac Parade in Canberra, but in the end, it didn't get. You wouldn't call it ecumenical or non-partisan, whereas the activity in Vietnam is, I think, a very touching story about reconciliation with the government of the Vietnamese Socialist Republic allowing just two foreign war memorials in the whole country, the French one at Dien Bien Phu and the Australian one at Long Tan. Mm. They are the only two former enemy monuments allowed by the new regime, and they attract substantial numbers of Australian visitors who are warned tactfully by their compatriots that they're not in their own country, and they shouldn't be behaving or appearing to behave in an ostentatiously Australian way.
Any monuments that recognise the role of Aboriginal soldiers?
A few. A small but increasing number do mention Aborigines. An occasional World War One, I think maybe only one World War One, one in Queensland that I mention in the book, has after one of the names on the pedestal, in brackets, Aboriginal. But in recent years, there have been fresh initiatives in Darwin, for example. There's a plaque went up a few years ago to Aborigines who served under Bill Stanner in a unit, a sort of commando unit that patrolled around waiting for Japanese invaders. And it's interesting, the Department of Veterans Affairs headquarters in Canberra is now called Lovett Tower, named in honour of an Aboriginal family who contributed, I think, about 11 people to World Wars, to the Army in two World Wars. What's much harder, and what's a nettle that hasn't been grasped yet, is whether we put up memorials to people who died in encounters between black and white on Australian soil.
And that was Ken, master of the Inglis language, speaking about his updated edition of Sacred Places, War Memorials in the Australian Landscape, published by Melbourne University Press. Ken, we'll all miss you terribly.